CFUW supports women, tries to fight poverty, certainly wants to take a stand against violence against women, and this is an opportunity that's appropriate and very important to the community that we live in, a rural community where gender-based violence, intimate partner violence, is epidemic.
The vigil takes place Saturday, December 6th at 10:30 a.m., beginning at the Halliburton Highlands Museum.
County Close-Up is made possible through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. You can find more stories from Halliburton County on canoefm.com and frequencynews.ca. This is Elizabeth Oakley for County Close-Up.
Thanks to Elizabeth Oakley and Canoe FM for that report on their memorial for the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women and the École Polytechnique tragedy. Here in Burnaby, tomorrow, Friday, December 25th, there is a similar event. A bunch of groups here at SFU, the SFU Women in Engineering, the SFU Sexual Violence and Prevention Support and Prevention Office, the Faculty of Applied Sciences, the SFU Human Rights Office, SFU Bullying and Harassment Central Hub, SFU Academic Women, the Office of the Vice President, People, Equity, and Inclusion, and the Simon Fraser Student Society Women's Center, all collaborating to put together an event which starts at the Memorial Bench, which is outside the Faculty of Applied Science building. And then a walk to a community conversation in the ballroom of the Student Union building, which is on the fifth floor of this building that the station is in. That's tomorrow, Friday, December 5th. The vigil at the bench starts at 12:15, that memorial bench just outside the Faculty of Applied Sciences building, and the memorial conversation happening here in the Student Union building from 12:45 to 1:30 p.m., you can find the event on events.sfu.ca or eventbrite.ca if you want to register, just in case weather prevents in-person attendance. There will be a Zoom link. And there are also memorial displays set up in the lobby of Vancouver's Harbour Centre campus and in the Surrey campus in the SRYC mezzanine and SRYE atrium. So make sure you go participate in this and take action to end violence against women here and around the world. Okay, let's hear a little bit more local music. This is Self Care. We'll be right back.
Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On November 13th, BC Human Rights Commissioner Kasari Govender released a statement regarding the provincial government's ongoing response to BC's toxic drug crisis. In the statement, Govender calls on the BC government to emphasize evidence-based policies in order to address the crisis, accusing their current focus on criminalization and involuntary care as being influenced by stigma. To learn more about Govender's statement, as well as what proposed actions she believes the province should be taking in order to address the toxic drug crisis, we sat down for a conversation where she was able to explain her reasons for releasing this statement.
So we released a position statement on the toxic drug crisis. In many ways, it reflects what many experts in the field have been saying for a long time, and it brings that into a human rights perspective, essentially arguing that, you know, in order to respect the human rights of folks directly who are directly impacted, people who use substances, who come from all walks of life, some of whom deal with substance dependence, addiction, but some of whom don't. All folks, to prioritize their rights, we need to take policy steps that are rooted in the evidence rather than in ideology. So that means prioritizing, for example, safe supply, access to safe supply, and harm reduction services, rather than emphasizing criminal law responses to the toxic drug crisis.
We then asked Govender to expand on her statement that the BC government's actions towards the toxic drug crisis were being driven by stigma of drug use and drug users.
I worry that the response has been based on, in part at least, on kind of an understanding that, you know, prioritizing, first of all, kind of the perspective that this is about safety on our streets for non-drug users, rather than prioritizing the lives and the human rights of those who do use substances. That's not to say that all of us don't want safe streets, that all of us benefit from communities where we feel like ourselves and our families, our children are safe in our parks and in our public spaces. We absolutely do. And happily for us, getting more safety in our streets and our parks is the same as respecting people's human rights who actually use drugs, which is we need a solution to this problem. You know, a lot of people in the wake of this, with much of the negative comments in the wake of releasing the statement have been, you don't care about the problem. You don't care about the people who are dying. You just think people should be able to kind of use drugs and as much as they want, and you're sort of promoting their suffering. In fact, this is the opposite. This is about saying what actually addresses the toxicity of drugs. These are the substances that are killing people or causing serious brain damage. You know, let's actually get to what the real solutions are. And the evidence shows that the real solutions lie in these kinds of public policy responses that may not intuitively at first feel right. But it's not about what's intuitive. It's actually about what the evidence supports. So I very much want to address the toxic drug supply. I very much want to ensure that people are not dying and seriously injured through toxic drugs. And ultimately, that will make all of us safer, whether we're directly impacted by this crisis from someone we love in our lives or ourselves, or just because we see this around us in our communities.
Later on in our conversation, we asked Kasari Govender to provide examples of different places in Canada as well as the world that have enacted policies similar to what she is advocating for.
I mean, I think every context is different for sure. When we can look to certain countries in Europe, we can look to Portugal and others to see how some of these policies have rolled out. Unfortunately, you know, the evidence from Canada either hasn't been listened to or hasn't been given enough time to play out. So, but we can see the evidence of how we've done so far under a prohibition model. under a model where access to substances is illegal, rather than the focus being on the safety of the substances that people are accessing. And we can see that because this drug toxicity crisis has arisen in the context of a prohibition model. It's arisen in the context of the existing, you know, legal structure, which says that drugs are criminalized, and that therefore we wouldn't try to make the drug supply safer. We would just try to eliminate it altogether. Well, that's great in theory, but that actually hasn't worked. That's exactly what gave rise to this situation in the first place.
Lastly, Kasari Govender left us with some more suggestions for what she believes needs to be prioritized when addressing the toxic drug crisis in BC.
So in my view, it's this position, again, despite how it's sometimes being represented, this position is not opposed to all forms of involuntary care. Sometimes involuntary care can be the right step from a human rights perspective if it is the last resort. If the science backs up that people will actually come out better than healthier than they went in, and that they have the right safeguards in place so that they can challenge the fact that they're being detained against their will or the conditions under which they're being detained. Those are all vital elements of having an involuntary care system. But even before we get to that point, we need to ask ourselves where we're spending all of our energy in terms and money and resources in terms of addressing this crisis. Where we need to be spending that is getting access to treatment options that exist now voluntarily. Putting aside for a second, we need access to safe supply, we need harm reduction facilities, we also need access to voluntary mental health services. You know, I think probably everyone listening, I certainly can draw multiple examples from my community, of loved ones, family and friends, of folks who tried desperately to get access to services and were unable to do it. And that worsened their mental health, it worsened their reliance on substances because there just weren't the resources available at that front end. Let's invest properly in services where people can actually choose to access services. That is a human rights respecting model, respects people's agency. But in addition to that, we also respect the science. I'm not a scientist, I'm a lawyer. That's partly why we put together this statement, so that we could look at the evidence out there and ensure that, you know, we weren't basing this kind of legal model in something that doesn't have actual basis in life. But what we see is that the evidence backs up the use of voluntary care services, it backs up safe supply, backs up harm reduction. And so we know that, you know, there's some really problematic evidence about what happens when people are put into involuntary care only for substance use disorder. So were they not for other mental health issues, but only for substance use disorder. And then they come out and sometimes are more vulnerable and are more likely to overdose and die as a result. So we need to make sure that we gain we're making policy decisions that are actually based in the evidence.
Once again, that was our conversation with BC Human Rights Commissioner Kasari Govender on a statement she made where she claims that the BC government is currently addressing the toxic drug crisis through policies that stem from stigma rather than evidence. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
And myself, I think God bless me that I'm survived today. When the shrapnel threw my arm, some friend of mine died by shrapnel. My arm a lot of bleeding.
That's the voice of Kum Mem, who sometimes likes to be called Tom. He's a young man who works at the Siem Reap War Museum in Cambodia. I met him recently on a trip this past October. He's a landmine survivor, a war guide, and has a great sense of humor. He's one of my guests on today's show, where we're going to be talking about landmines, amputees, and issues faced by people living in the Global South. My name is David Peck, and welcome to CJSF Radio. I've asked Noel Hutchinson to join us today for the show to tell us a little bit about his experience. He's the Executive Director for Asian Outreach International Canada. He spent a great deal of time in Southeast Asia and has a deep love and passion for the country of Cambodia. Noel?
When I first flew into Cambodia, mid-90s, I was actually quite unprepared for what I saw, for what I felt. It was shocking, to say the least. And I think the thing that was most compelling for me, it wasn't that I didn't understand poverty. We worked in very impoverished villages and communities in northern Thailand among the ethnic minorities and the hill tribes and things like that. But there was just something different about what I experienced in my first trip to Cambodia. And I think in many ways it prepared me for all of our involvement ever since that point.
And yet, now looking back, you can say I've been working in the country for how many years?
Oh, it's got to be approaching 20 years now. And really, it was what I experienced in that first 2 weeks in the country that were the seed and my motivation and this passion and heart for Cambodia that just grew out of what I saw there. There was this beauty about people. There was this resilience. In the midst of all this devastation, I think what captivated me was just something simple. Like if you wanted to take somebody's picture, they would just burst into these radiant smiles, almost like you care enough to notice me, to look at me. And I left the country really not wanting to go back in some senses. But then it wasn't long before it was like, man, I got to go back. And it was out of this that this huge passion and love for Cambodia just began to develop in my life.
After about a 20-minute tuk-tuk ride from the main center of Siem Reap, we landed at the War Museum, and I was actually there with a friend of mine, Sean Dell. We're currently filming a documentary movie about another war guide there in his life and how he's dealt with his past and so on and how he's building for a future. And it was then that we met Coom, or Tom, and I was immediately impressed by Tom's ability to connect. He was just such a deeply relational guy. He spoke great English. He had this beautiful smile and this great sense of humor, and it was there that we decided we need to interview this guy for a variety of reasons. Tom.
Oh, I lost my arm when I was 14 years old. That is a bad luck for me in my life. That we walked together with the friend in the field near the Thailand border, and we looking for scrap metal. And some friend, they found a mine. They don't know this thing is like a toy. They play them with a friend and explode. Some friend around close by, they die by shrapnel because mini bleeding. They design landmine from, I know they not killed, just wound injured. They say one injured fire, sick army here to take care. But my friend, bad luck, they die by bleeding far away from hospital. And bad luck for me, my arm, left arm, a lot of bleeding. If happened today, I think my arm is fine. They can operation, take a shrapnel, save my arm. That time, some friend, they try to save my life. They become a doctor. They took a small, tiny wire, metal wire, cutting my arm. No injection, no painkiller. And I remember they gave me smoking. Do you know ganja? Ganja like painkiller. They told me, they give to me to smoke. But I cough a lot. I give back to my friend, and my friend, they give back to me. They say more smoke because ganja like painkiller. And then make me very thirsty. I need to drink. I talk to them. Please give me water, please. They say, cannot get a drink. Yeah, get a drink, more bleeding. And my heart jammed because that time I had run fast. And I see some friend, they walking, they bring coconut fruit. In my mind, I think they let me drink the coconut juice. After they walking, come to me. I pass out. When I open my eye again, my older friend, he told me 3-9 already that I can't open my eye. When I see my arm gone, I'm always feel sad, little cry. One of my older friend, he say, don't cry, don't worry anything. He tried to tell me, one day when I grow up, He said, my arm will grow.
Karen Valley, the director of the War Amps Amputee Center in Ottawa, Canada, brings her helpful perspective as an amputee and a woman who has worked with the organization for over 20 years.
It's a challenge sometimes to define what disabled means because you're trying to reconcile what your internal definition of versus where you are in society and what society's expectation is or their interpretation of the world. And what your interaction is with the world at that particular moment in time. You know, in my own personal experience, I've had great moments where I have felt anything but disabled, and then other moments where not having a second hand has truly been an insurmountable challenge. And so in that moment, if I was standing next to a peer, they with two hands would be able to achieve that, and I with one could not. So in that moment, the only thing that defined the difference that I could see would be the, you know, the lack of the second hand. And yet there are other things that I could do much better than a peer, regardless of the number of hands I have or that they have. So I think sometimes we attach labels to things because it's an easy category to put us in, but I don't think living with a disability is as black and white as that.
You know, here's a statistic in speaking about those with physical disabilities, that they figure there are still between 150 and 200 unexploded ordinances that go off every quarter in this country. So just coming alongside communities that are dealing with even the repercussions and the fallout from unexploded ordinances is huge.
But landmine victim like me or my friend, we had to get a job. One thing had to get a friend. Some Cambodian, they very look down the landmine victim. They hate the soldier. They say army is the killer. So they don't care which army, good or bad, but they say army is the killer. Some people hate the army. People look down, they don't want to talk, they want to make friend with. And one more thing, had to get the school. Like we try to study too, but we have no government support us to the school and had to get a job. Like many places before I work here, I try to get a job, guest house, hotel, a lot of places, they say, don't have both arms, cannot work. But I say, I can. But they say, no, cannot work. One time, real story, I tried to be a receptionist at one guest house. I say, I can. You know, I write CV to them. I got interview because I didn't tell them I'm missing arm. I got interview. I'm happy to go. They see me missing arm. They say, oh, sorry, I didn't say I lost arm. So they say I cannot be a receptionist. I change my mind. I say I can be a cleaner. I'm strong. But they say, no, one arm hard. So they didn't give me a job. And I try to be speaking English tour guide. That I told you it's can, because the rural government missing cannot be a tour guide. But I got hard brain. I don't want to be back on the street. We need to work.
The number of factors in a place like Cambodia that can come into play, often in culture that has those types of experiences with disability, those living with disabilities hide their disabilities or they hide themselves. And so society isn't exposed to it, doesn't see it, doesn't have experience with it, doesn't see the positives, the benefits of interacting with or knowing someone with a disability. We know in Canadian culture that if you have a worker with a disability, they are often more loyal than another worker might be, because it's been a challenge to get a job, and so that job is valued in a way it can't be for anyone else. It's going to be too hard to get another job somewhere else because of perceived bias or real bias that might be out there. So attendance is better, the work quality is better, the loyalty is stronger. And so when you don't see that in your everyday experiences, there's a lot more myth or mysticism built up behind it, and it's rarely do we boldly and with passion accept those things we don't know. We often, we're scared of things we don't know or understand. New experiences aren't always embraced with zest.
Paul Hannon, the executive director of Minds Action Canada, joins us to talk to us about how he thinks we are winning the war on landmine clearance and unexploded ordnance in the global south.
Do a triage in terms of what the clearance needs are, and then start making sure you have enough donors and enough money to do that properly, and you train local people. You don't bring in a ton of expats. You don't bring in a ton of Canadians to do this, even if there may be Canadian military people who know how to do it. You bring in a trainer or two, maybe a supervisor or two, and then you train the local people, who most of whom can't work anyways because the land is contaminated. So you're giving them employment. They have a motivation to clear the land because they want to live on it. And you're getting the community to rebuild itself. You're helping the community rebuild itself and clear itself. So that's, I think, a second main task you take. And the third task is that you have to help people understand, particularly the leadership and at the national and the local level, that people who have been victims of the weapon, landmine survivors, have rights, and it's not their fault.
I experienced the same thing as a teenager. I was able to keep the job, but it is that judgment, that visual judgment that is made, and having to overcome that judgment and prove the other person wrong that, yes, you can do it, and you end up sort of doing a superhuman effort to over-impress because you feel that you're starting from a deficit position.
The war ended. A lot of people's living the poverty, that a lot of problems. So I'm happy work here with a lot of my friends and the landmine victim to tell tourists about how Cambodian people that suffering in the war. I'm happy work here. I want to tell the youth generation of Cambodian, one day they grow up, don't go to the war, and tell all the tourists around the world that visit this museum should not make a war. I'm very glad to tell all the tourists here about all those happen, that they are very lucky because their country no war, no landmine, but they come to Cambodia, that Cambodia a lot of landmine. But now Cambodia is peaceful, no problem. Tourists can visit Cambodia, and Cambodia people open mind, open heart to tell what happened through Cambodia war.
So we have a whole pile of people to thank for this show. Richard Essler, who is the manager at the Siem Reap War Museum in Siem Reap, Cambodia. Please get out to see Richard and his guides and the museum if you get to that part of Cambodia in the near future. And to Tom or Kum, our very special guest who shared his part of his story with us. And of course, our panel of experts, Paul Hannon from Minds Action Canada, Noel Hutchinson from Asian Outreach International Canada, and Karen Valley, the director of War Amps National Amputee Center in Ottawa. And of course, our sound guy and all around good guy show like producer Josh Sethledge from Mixed Media Sound. This show wouldn't have been possible without the support and assistance of CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Thanks for joining us. My name is David Beck.
The Slate Family Foundation Legacy Program was created by the Unison Fund to support Canadian music industry veterans. For more information on this lifeline of hope, visit unisonfund.ca.